Hey, it's Christine from Storyworthy. Today on the show, author Annabelle Gurwitch talks about being the sketchy one in the house.
They introduce me to a couple who are young people who are covered in facial tats. And I'm like, anybody but those people, the tatted, potentially gang members. I meet these people again once for coffee. And so I thought, okay, I'll do this. They show up at my house and they're 3 hours late. I learned they've been living in their car. The first thing they do when they show up at my house is they call their parents. And I'm like, what? Homeless people have parents?
Today on the show, author and activist Annabelle Gurwitch talks about being the sketchy one in the house. Stay close.
Hey, this is Annabelle Gurwitch, and you are listening to Storyworthy.
Welcome to Storyworthy. My name is Christine Blackburn, and I'm coming to you from Los Angeles, California. Whether you're a longtime fan of the show or a new listener, welcome to Storyworthy. Now, I hope you guys had a chance to listen to the show last week with big cat activist Carol Baskin. I got a lot of attention for having Carol Baskin on the show. You can imagine, Annabelle. And you know, the funniest thing, though, about Carol is that she's very well-spoken. She's very bright. She's very educated. And dare I say, she's totally normal.
I don't believe you for a second. You know, the thing is, like, I watched that documentary. And, okay, one thing I just think about that story as, like, things that happen in Florida. I say yes. That as someone who grew up in Florida. Florida is just fucking weird. And it's just like people, it's sort of in a way it has something in common with Los Angeles and sort of like the way that people can sort of recreate themselves in Los Angeles and that sort of mythic quality of like move out and assume a new identity. There's something like that in Florida too. And I just think, where else would you be married to someone who's probably gay, and then they're living in a threesome, and they also have big cats. I don't know. The whole thing, and they're living in this fantasy world, the costumes, the cats, the weird marriage, but the open, it's all so nuts, you know?
It really was. And when you listen to Carol Baskin's episode last week, you'll see that, you know, she was approached by these producers in a different way than what actually happened, right? Like, she thought she was going to be at the center of, like, a Blackfish movie. Remember that movie? And it did a lot for dolphins and saving dolphins. And she thought this was going to be the same
with
the tigers.
Well, that's part of the crazy. How do you think that when you know the story? I mean, it's just, it's a fantasy world. It's crazy.
Tiger King, the proper Tiger King, Joe Exotica, The producers lived with him and followed him for 5 years. And so right off the bat, this is tragic because that means they saw what he had on his property, which were hundreds of cats in these tiny little kennels that were just cement with bars. And it was row after row after row after row after big cat in these totally inappropriate cages, not eating right, etc. And then he's killing the animals after they don't have their use for him anymore, after they're too old to be pet, after the cubs are too old, then he just kills them. And anyway, the guy was doing so much illegal and so much wrong. And then the producers, they never called him on it. They just kept rolling. And then he brings in Carol Baskin and they just present her to be a completely crazy lady. And her story is crazy, but she's doing a lot of good
Wait,
work.
Am I getting you know what? Oh my God. I have gotten confused between two crazy stories, the Carol Baskin story and the cat dance documentary. I'm thinking of Cat Dance because all these people are nuts. Oh, yeah. Right. I'm totally confused, but they all involve crazy cat people who live in Florida. So why wouldn't I get it confused? Because it all smushed into one. Wait, have you seen Cat Dance?
No, now I really want to.
You have to see Cat Dance now.
Oh, I can't wait.
That's insane.
Is that on Netflix or what's that on?
I don't know. Stop everything and just go find it because
okay, I will. It,
these
I will.
Things are just there. So yes, and I know it's the whole thing.
It's a crazy world, but Carol Baskin's actually doing some good work over at Big Cat Rescue. You could check out her website, bigcatrescue.org. It's actually a tremendously good site. It's a really well done site, and Carol is just a freaking machine, man. Annabelle, she has 200 people working on her social media.
How do you know that? Okay, Christine, maybe that's all in her head. We don't know that.
That's 200?
That's of course what she said. What are 200 people possibly doing? I mean, think about it. I want you to just stop for a second and just, there's like thing called, you know, unreliable narrator. And she told you who has 200 people?
She's got the big, big company now. It's a massive property, a massive organization. Here's something you would laugh at, Annabelle. Mm-hmm. I asked her if she lived at the rescue. Did she live at Big Cat mm-hmm. Rescue? And she said, I did, but we had to turn my house into the gift shop.
Oh, me too. So, you know, the funny thing is, Christine, I just had to turn my house into a gift shop too. So I'm now living in a shed in the back of my house because I'm also in a fantasy world. No, I'm sure she is doing it and there is a gift shop. But I don't know. When you hear, like, to who has 200 people? I don't think Arianna Huffington has like five personal assistants and an empire. I don't think she has 200 people working
well,
on her.
She also
media.
Wasn't on Tiger King, so I'm just saying.
Well, yeah. Oh, I just, you know what? I just don't know anything anymore. I mean, in a world where there's Tiger King, Cat Dance, I don't know what is happening. Anymore.
River Dance. Yeah.
Who knows?
Hey, listen. Who knows? I am so glad you're here because you've been on Storyworthy before, but it's been several years. And it really has. And the last time you were on, it was you were telling a story from your book, I See You Made an Effort.
Oh my God, that's two books ago. That's crazy.
I know. And I have to tell you, you just have you have a wonderful way with words. I absolutely adore your writing. I adore you as a person. But your book titles are always so flipping spot on. And this goes all the way back to your book that you co-wrote with your ex-husband. You say tomato, I say shut up. So that, you know, you got me right there. You grabbed me there as a friend and as a longtime reader of yours.
I love a good title.
A good title, right?
Yeah.
And so then the I See You Made an Effort, that title, that is a story that I actually repeat to many people. If we're, you know, if that ever comes up, I mention that. Because tell the audience why you named the book I See You Made an Effort.
You know, that's a collection of stories that I wrote about being on the precipice of 50, of turning 50, and was trying to find a title for that. And I happened to be getting ready at the time. I was still acting. Writing has really taken over my life, but I was acting and I was going to go to an audition to play a mother, which I am. And it was to play a mother of a child, the exact same age my child actually is, which really means I'm like 1,000 years older in Hollywood because, you know, 50 is 80 in Hollywood years. So I go, I'm like, I'm going to make, you know, I'm going to do my best and like try really hard for this. And so I go to my, I get really dressed up. I think I'm looking pretty great. And I go to get my hair done and my longtime hairdresser says to me, oh, I see you made an effort. And I was like, what? Oh, wait, is that the best I can expect now that I'm this age? Not like, you look great. Hey, like hot mama, whatever. Nothing like that. Just like effort. That's what it's come to.
Backhanded.
It was, I know he's British and he does have a very dry sense of humor, but it was so funny and that I just thought it just captured so well the indignity of aging, of, well, you know, that's the best you can do. And it also just captured something which I've always said too, is I'm not interested in aging gracefully. I'm just aging with a vengeance. I'm just not going away. And that sort of captured that thing too, of a sort of indignant quality that I feel mm-hmm. I've carry with me on a daily basis, of just not leaving. Sorry, old lady here. And, you know, so the funniest part that way. Christine, is that when I went for that audition, I did not get the role of mother in this commercial, but I did get cast. It was one of these DirecTV commercials, so it's like they time traveled. It was like a huge production, and instead of getting asked to play a mom, I was cast as a crone in the Middle Ages. And
what is a crone?
That's a crone, like an old lady. Is an old lady. And of course, a crone in the Middle Ages would have meant like you were 30, you know. And the best part of that was I get to the set and I'm just sure they've like got me dressed up in these like gunny sack, lumpy. I look like a lumpen potato. I've got this babushka on my head. And I'm sure also that they're going to say, oh, we're going to need like an hour in hair and makeup to, you know, age up. They take one look at me and they're like, you look great. I'm like, what? I naturally look like a crone in the Middle Ages. No, oh no, no makeup needed here. It was, you know, it's just like one indignity piled upon the next, you know.
Absolutely. Now, the another book that you wrote about your family yes. also had a clever title.
Oh, clever.
Wherever you are, there you are.
No,
wait,
no.
How's it
Wherever,
going?
It's so clever that it can't be said out loud. it's like Rosebud. Ring.
Wherever you go, there you are.
No, that's the original book that I'm being satirical. It's Wherever You Go, There They Are.
Right. And that's so funny about
your family.
Your family is your family is your family. And that book was also terrific. Talked a lot about your mom, a lot about your dad. You know, you were born in Alabama. I always felt it was so interesting how your father had a lot of money, then didn't have any money. Then he had a lot of money, then he didn't have any money.
Yes, I would say interesting was not the word that I would describe the childhood of growing up with a flim-flam dad. But
it wasn't stable, and that's hard. It's got to be hard.
Well, the thing is, you know, as always, I think humor is really redemptive, and humor is the lens that I look through life with. But that book was really based on the idea that, well, first of all, it was each essay in that book is about a different kind of family tribe, you know, like families you join and families that you are born into.
Right.
But it was also based on the idea that, you know, I don't know people who have perfect childhood. I'm sure they're out there, perfect lives. And, you know, by telling the stories of this crazy, chaotic life we had, from, you know, my dad driving around in a Silver Cloud Rolls Royce to losing our home and having to move in with our family because we had nothing. And, you know, I think that it helps destigmatize everyone's experience. And that was the idea. Of course, by the way, the worst thing that can happen to anyone's family is to have a writer born into it. And I was a couple years ago at a funeral where I was voted least favorite member of the family because
it turns out, no way.
Yes, it turns out someone was very unhappy about what I wrote about my cousin's dad. And, you know, you'll never make everyone happy when you were writing about your family.
Let me ask you, what was that Rolls Royce all about?
Well, the thing is, my dad always loved cars, and he had a big surprise, someone who is a flim-flam guy who had brief dealings with the mafia, and, you know, he had every kind of business. So he had silver mines. He was briefly in the softcore porn distribution. He had fast food restaurants. Everything was based upon, like, some exaggeration. Like, the fast food restaurant, their big thing was they had a foot-long French fry. There is no foot-long French fry. It does not exist. But he also, like, big surprise, had a used car lot.
And dealership. Yeah, sure.
The Rolls-Royce came from the used car business. And, you know, I mean, it was so beautiful. But at some point, because of all kinds of, you know, terrible business dealings that he had, which he just could never hold on to money. And we ended up, like, having no money. So we were living on fast food, as you do. And so we would go to the Kentucky Fried Chicken and eat our right out of the bucket, of course, because you can't have Kentucky Fried Chicken and not eat it immediately before it congeals into a fat casing of just, right, you know, artery clogging goo. But we'd sit and eat it in the back of the Rolls Royce, because that's what you do when you're our family.
Yeah. Who had the better sense of humor, your mom or your dad?
Oh my God, this is the thing. My mother, she had a dry sense of humor, but it was not easy for her, you know, being married to my dad. And so I wouldn't say she had any sense of humor, although, you know, in the end of her life, and that book also is about coming back to take care of my parents in the end of their lives, even though I had very difficult relationships with them. And my mom, near the end of her life, her last words. I mean, you really can't place a lot of stock in last words, because a lot of times that's just, you know, coincidence, but really and truly, amongst her last words were, and it's just really, your dad really knew how to party. She was in an altered state at that point. But the other thing she said was, you know, nuts are really good to have around. And I took that to mean crazy people. And she also she really did like entertaining. And, you know, nuts are really practical. So that was her life wisdom that she passed on to me in the end of her, you know.
Like, she had a lot of, like, fancy dishes, little crystal bowls. Like, didn't she have a lot of nice things?
Well,
serving items.
She did, except that the thing I didn't know about when I was growing up, of course, was where they came from. And a lot of them came because we happened to move into a house when we went to Florida from Delaware. We were on a trek, you know, following the money. And the house that we rented and my parents eventually bought, although it doesn't really count as buying a house when you have three mortgages, and one of them was from Phil Rizzuto and the Money Store. I just want to say that. But the house had these beautiful, like, etched glasses, crystal glasses. So some of that just came by accident.
They were in the house.
And the woman who we were renting the house from died, and I don't think she had children. And so somehow or another, we ended up with it. But, in my new book, You're Leaving When, which just came out in 2020, a couple months ago, 2021 in March. Yeah. You're Leaving When, Adventures in Downward Mobility. In this new book, one of the things I write about is about how I failed Marie Kondo's life-changing magic of tidying up. And I, since my parents have died and since I've gotten divorced, my house resembles that sediment drawing that we all saw in our grade school science books where it has like the Earth's crust and then down to the core and those like pie things. I have just layers and layers of my house is full of so much stuff. My parents' stuff, their parents' stuff that I inherited because I have the house and my sister has an apartment now. And so I've got all that stuff, the stuff my kid left when they went to college. And then like my reusable water bottles that were turned to bongs during Ezra's weed smoking days. I mean, it's just like layers and layers. So it might be like crystal champagne glasses, which I have like 30 of. Who needs crystal champagne? Who needs 30 champagne glasses?
You are ready to throw a party at any second.
And,
you really
well,
are.
That's the thing is, in my childhood, we had this set of crystal glasses. Like, nobody, who, what, like, it was like Great Gatsby in the pantry. but we weren't those people. So, you know, it's just, and my house now reflects that. It's, the Smithsonian's going to come in someday and just like...
That's funny. Now, you bring forth the topic today. Mm. Who's the sketchy one in a house? And I know this is based on a script that you wrote for HBO based on a story in the latest book.
Yeah.
You're Leaving When.
Yeah.
And so we're going to get to that story in just a second. But I'm thinking to myself, who's the sketchy one in the house? I'm thinking about my own family. There were eight of us in the house. And I don't know about the sketchy one, but I was the black sheep for sure. Sketchy is a different word, but I'm just thinking about like the context of my family, eight of us, and basically just being in such a large family by the end, you know, when the kids, you know, you count all those kids down by the time I was born and raised, there was no more raising. You know what I mean? Like I basically raised myself.
Do any pictures exist of your childhood or?
Very few. Yeah. There's about 8 or 10.
Phantom.
Because, because, you know, that was back when they had to have film and, you know, anyway, it was just a different time, youngest of six. And so I would say if there was a sketchy one in the house, it would be me. But it was more just that I left. You know what I mean? I'm the one that left the Pittsburgh area and kind of went out.
Well, it's funny because this story involves people who come from Pennsylvania.
Oh, well, then I know I'm going to like those people because Pennsylvania people are very good. Anyway, we're going to get over your story in just a second, but I did want to remind everybody that we are back at the Hollywood Improv playing Story Smash, the storytelling game show, once a month down at the Improv. The next date is September 25th, coming up right now, next weekend, and then we go to October 23rd and November 27th. So mark your calendars for Story Smash. It is so darn funny, and we're laughing so hard. They do have the room, you know, they're only booking or selling like 40 tickets, so it's not as many people in the room. Everybody has to show proof of vax, and so... you know, we're taking some precautions, but I do hope people come on out and see it. Check out storysmashshow.com for more information and follow Story Smash on Instagram for all of the show pictures at Story Smash. All right. She's here right now, you guys. Annabelle Gurwitz, you hear her talking. She is the author of I See You Made an Effort, like we talked about. And that was a New York Times bestseller, like some of your other books are New York Times bestsellers. And that was also, you got a Thurber Prize finalist. The Thurber Prize, I thought that was for you as a person. Was it just for that book?
The prize was made up for me personally. No, it's,
I'm just not sure.
Actually, that is my only book that's a New York Times bestseller. I've now written 5 books. That book was the Thurber Prize is, you know, as a humor writer, there's not a lot of awards out there, but there is the Thurber Prize for American humor writing, and I've been a finalist for that.
And so didn't Mark Twain win that?
Gee, I don't. Know if Mark Twain, I think this comes after Mark Twain, you know, the James Thurber, wonderful.
I'm very impressed by it, and I'm impressed by all of your books. Like you said, you have written 5 books total, and then you were also the longtime host of Dinner and a Movie on TBS. And you know, that was an interstitial show where you chat, cook, and then show a movie. And then, you know, Annabelle, I did that too with Ready for the Weekend, but my show only ran for 2 years. You're your show, that dinner and a movie ran for a long time, right?
1,000 years. And we did, I guess it was over 200 episodes.
Yeah.
And it was, but you know, it's funny because I have all these, VHS tapes.
Yeah.
and some DVDs, and I just, it's not really on the internet, but I'm thinking if anyone's listening and you want to turn these into digital, files for me, I will put them up because people have asked me.
Sure.
And I just have not had the bandwidth to do
that. Yeah, I understand. I did send away a bunch of my VHSs and DVDs a couple years ago to get digitized.
Did they come back?
Oh yeah.
I'm just confused.
It's so great. And
okay.
It comes back and it's on this little file, and it's like all that shit in those boxes is now like in this little file in your hand. It's amazing.
Oh my God. That's part of my sediment layers is a layer of VHS tapes.
Now, you also are a regular NPR contributor.
And you've written
for The New Yorker, The New York Times, Los Angeles Magazine, the LA Times, The Wall Street Journal, amongst other publications.
Yes.
And right now you're co-hosting the Tiny Victories podcast on the Maximum Fun Podcast Network. And I have to tell you, I love Tiny Victories so much. You and comedian Laura House every week putting out these little tiny podcasts are 15 minutes long, and it's just it's just little victories, things that get us through the day. I think it's adorable. I really love the show.
Yeah, well, our idea was that, you know, we're living in a time where it's hard to sustain like a feeling of like things are going great. It's really a tough time for everyone in the world, and so perhaps the best thing we posit in the show is to cultivate an appreciation of small mercies. So a tiny victory is something that no one's going to write about in the newspaper, but is a big deal to you or to some part of the world. And so it is a tiny podcast. It's 15 minutes or less, just a little nugget of goodness.
I love
it. And humor, of course.
Yeah.
So
I absolutely love it. And I don't see why like NPR doesn't pick it up as one of their little, like a little, you know, a 15-minute slot on NPR once a week, or like I could just see
I think that's a great idea.
I do too.
Christine,
I'm going to make some calls.
I'm going to do that
right now.
Do that. Just stop everything, Chris.
You know,
and call people and let them know.
NBC, they got some shows. Give them a call.
Yes, I'm all for it.
And your media appearances do include Good Morning America, Real Time with Bill Maher, CBS Early Morning Show, The Today Show, Oprah, and the PBS NewsHour. So you've been on a lot of different shows. I know you were just on Good Morning America with Christopher Reeve's son. He's a handsome guy.
He is a very handsome guy. And it was actually very sweet when I moved to New York to become an actress. One of the first plays I saw was Christopher Reeve on stage. So just to see that next, and I met him once or twice, just briefly. And I mean, as anyone will tell you, he was just this kind and wonderfully generous person. He was already Superman, and he really was a super person. And so, you know, it is this funny thing to be this age where you get to meet people's children and you have this sort of next generation connection. And if there's any upside of getting to be in the, you know, in the older generation, it's getting to help bring up this next generation. Of course, Christopher Reeve's kid, Will Reeve, needs no help from me. He's just tremendously awesome and also gorgeous.
Yeah, he really is. I like to see him. I like to see him do well.
Yes.
I mean, I want, you know, when you see like these good parents and you think like, you know, I hope their kids do well, and it makes you feel good to do that. You know, who I think has done very well is Jenna Bush. Have you seen Jenna Bush on, is it whatever show she's on, the Today Show or whichever one that is?
On GMA. In fact, You're Leaving When, it was a GMA must read book.
I like her.
Yeah,
don't you like her?
You're going to put me on the spot here. And of course I like her. What's not to like about Jenna? Yes. I mean.
No, but I mean, I guess I just like to see that. I like to see, because people always think like, oh, well, if your parents are successful or wealthy, well, of course you're going to be wealthy and successful. And it's like, no, not at all. And it makes me feel hope when you see somebody grounded, doing the work, and, you know, and like carrying on a tradition.
It can be a lot when your parents are super successful. And that's why I always tell my child, I'm proud of the work I've done, but I've, you know, in some sense I've middled, and I do that on purpose for you, Ezra, because I don't want you to feel intimidated by my success. So I have purposefully not achieved everything I wanted to, because this way it'll be, you'll do better. And so that's, you know, no pressure. No guilt, but yeah, that's what I'm going
with. Yeah. And I'm raising, as you know, my 14-year-old girl. And, you know, she's at that age, you know, where she likes to say things that'll hurt me or say things that'll, you know, whatever, just to get me, right? And she knows me so well. Of course, your child always knows you the best. She knows how to, like, rib me or push me. And so she'll say things like, you always say on your podcast. Do you know that? Or something like that. She'll say things that get really personal with me.
Oh, my God. Ezra is so critical of me.
Right?
I mean, when I – they're living with me right now. They are graduated from Bard. And they're actually stories that involve my being the parent of a – and also – adjusting to being the parent of a non-binary person, which my child is, which I'm very supportive of, but definitely there was an adjustment period. And I write about that journey, but because they are a Gen Z person and we are sharing a home right now. When I walk out of the bedroom to go out in the day, I don't even get, I see you made an effort. What I got is, Mom, no. Mom, let me dress you. You would think I was walking around wearing like a trash bag, which actually would be preferable because they really like blobby, baggy clothes. But this is actually what the story I'm going to talk about today is about, which is home sharing.
I'm so excited. Yes. That's right. All right. So you guys can find more about Annabelle over at her website, AnnabelleGerwich.com, and also on Twitter at LAGerwich. And I'm excited to hear your story about who's the sketchy one in the house. So wherever you are, guys, put your hands together for the very talented Annabelle Gerwich.
So this story takes place where I find myself in a position where basically I'm thinking, how am I going to afford to stay in my house when I just gotten divorced? And as many people know, divorce is really makes you, amongst other things, financially unstable. And the plan that I came up with, because real estate prices in Los Angeles are insane, I realized, oh my God, if I sell my house, I might make some money, but where am I going to live? Not in Los Angeles. I'm going to end up like in a dusty motel up the 5 freeway in the middle of California next to a cement plant. So I come up with a plan, which is to rent out the bedroom in my house, an extra bedroom in my house now that my kid has gone off to college. And of course, in my mind, I'm thinking, okay, oh my God, I am going to turn into this blousy 1950s landlady. I'm like serving oatmeal for breakfast to the itinerant workers who are going to come and stay in my home. I have this image of myself in the 1950s, basically, with a cigarette hanging out of my mouth. And of course, I find out this is not at all what's happening out there, but a lot of women, and it is mostly women, renting out rooms in their house. And I have a couple of tenants, people that come to me through people I know, and outside of one French tenant who turned my house into a weed dispensary, which, by the way, all of California is a weed dispensary now. From any open window, the scent, the wafting scent of weed fills your lungs, and you get a contact high, which is why people are smiling in yoga pants in Los Angeles all day, because they're all stoned from just like a contact high. But after, you know, after one or two experiences. It's going okay, and I have someone who is supposed to move in, but they cancel at the last minute. I mean, the week before they're supposed to move in, and I'm like, shit, what am I going to do? And I happened to hear on NPR about some kind of program that matches you with young people and that you get a stipend for having them come and stay in your house. It's called the Host Home Program. And I'm thinking they mean like foreign exchange students. So I call up and I say, I'm interested because there's money involved. And they invite me to come to this mixer at the organization's headquarters. So I show up at this place in Venice and there's like a drum circle and there's this outdoor catering and there's all these sort of rainbow flaggy people. Everybody is, well, it's very California. We're like mixing elixirs to help you sleep out of mashing things we're picking in the garden. And I know I'm supposed to be like mingling and possibly meeting people I'll invite to stay in my house, and I can't tell who are the people I'm supposed to invite, who's the staff there. I see I'm talking to some young person. They seem nice. I invite them to come live with me. It turns out they're the head of the organization. I have no idea who these people are. And I tell them, yeah, I'm possibly interested. And they introduce me to a couple who are young people who are covered in facial tats. And I'm like, anybody but those people, the tatted, potentially gang members. And as it turns out, I then find out that you actually get double the amount of money if you take in two people. So I sign up for it. Now I meet these people again once for coffee. And basically I'm thinking, well, okay, they might murder me in my sleep because they're covered in tattoos. They're strangers from an area in Pennsylvania I've never heard of. And I invite them into my house, and even though I'm convinced they're going to murder me because, again, there's money involved. And they show up at my house and they're 3 hours late. I learned they've been living in their car. And that's kind of what did it for me. Why I ended up inviting them in. It was not just the money. I wouldn't have done it if it hadn't been the money involved. But I thought about this young woman, because it was a young woman and a young man. And I thought about what that must be like being in the car, like if you have your period. And I thought, well, if things go really wrong for me, at least I'm in menopause. And I won't have my period when I'm living in my car. That's a plus. But I really felt terrible when I would picture her in this situation. And so I thought, okay, I'll do this. But just to be safe, I found this, I have this house full of just bursting with old stuff. And I found this rusty old hatchet in my garage. I put that under the pillow in my bedroom, and I staged there just in case they try to like break in some sort of like Charles Manson-y way to my bedroom and murder me in my sleep. I'll have this rusty hatchet. I hide my valuables. I invite them in. They move in, and they're 3 hours late, and I'm sure that's why they're homeless, because they're irresponsible. Of course, I find out, a month later, as we start to get to know each other, that they had to, that morning, their phone broke. They had to go to the storage unit where they were storing their stuff. They had done a DoorDash run. I mean, they were so trying to keep their lives together. And of course, it's really hard to get anywhere on time when you're living in your car. But of course, I didn't know that at that time. But the first thing they do when they show up in my house is they call their parents. And I'm like, what? Homeless people have parents? I mean, what I hadn't really realized was how much I had otherized people who were experiencing homelessness. I had this idea in my mind about who they were, basically, because they had also gotten these face tats. I mean, they were trying to become rappers. That's what I knew about them. And it just seemed like a terrible choice to have face tats. I mean, what kind of job can you get if you got face tats? And then the idea that they would call their parents, like they had parents. And over the next month, as they lived with me, I slowly started to see who they were. And of course, it was all so challenging to my ideas of who people are, my expectations, and what I think I know about people. You know, I was really in this terrible state in my life. You know, my marriage had fallen apart. My kid was off of college. They were in the process of becoming sober, which they're 5 years sober now, I'm happy to say. But I was just in this devastated moment. My parents had just died. So every night I would stand over the sink, shoving a rice cake into my mouth, and they were making salads and cooking, and I'd see her in my living room darning clothes she liked to sew. I'm like, who are these people? They joined a church. And I got to, as I slowly started to get to know them, I understood that, you know, I didn't know what I was looking at when I see people on the streets in Los Angeles. You know, homelessness has become this huge and very divisive issue out here and in many places in the country. And honestly, I would see people on the streets and I would think, well, why don't they go back home? It's their fault for trying to move here. And what are they thinking? They must be irresponsible. And the story emerged that I started to understand that these were young people who, first of all, grew up what we would call the children of the working poor. Their families who love them in Pennsylvania, in a town that's been really decimated by fracking, where employment has just disappeared. And there really was nowhere to go back to. And they were just reenacting what generations of Americans had done, including my family, moving to the cities, including myself, moving to a place to find employment. And in fact, this whole thing about having these face tats was actually something they had done in order to get work in the trap rap world that they wanted to be a part of. And in fact, it was working. They were getting attention for the way that they had, in some sense, accessorized themselves. And that was a deliberate and actual, you know, strategy that was working out, like me. Because we had much more in common than I realized. I had dropped out of college like them in order to make money quicker. They had each attended a year of college. These were not people who were these, what I thought, irresponsible people. And that, you know, they had moved to Los Angeles having had saved money, but of course the housing market is so expensive and they had gotten ripped off in certain scams and they had a weaker social network than I had. And we slowly started to get to know each other. And at some point, this really terrible thing happened, which is someone they knew who went by the name of Sketchy, a rapper, OD'd. And this was this moment, and they were just devastated. And as it turned out, of course, my first thought was, well, his name was Sketchy. What do you expect? This is the kind of people they know. It turned out that my kid knew this rapper, went by the name of Sketchy, and actually Sketchy was his nom de rap of this young person, and I actually knew his parents. And now we were an entire family under one house grieving the loss of this young person. And I did something that I had been too afraid to do up until that moment, which is I put their names into a Google search. And I wanted to see to one of these sites that checks out and sees people's records and their banking records, and it lets you know, who's basically, it gives you a score of what kind of trustworthy or untrustworthy person this is. And I put their names into this search engine, and I pull up and I see that he gets a score, and they get these scores of like whatever it is, what is it, like 3.9 out of 5 or something, or maybe it was like 4.3 out of whatever. They're like okay. They're like in the good range. I'm like, oh, okay, that's I guess that's good to know, but it could have been a better score. So just to get some perspective on how they rank in terms of trustworthiness in this, central database, I put my name in the search engine. And my score is lower than their score. The minute my name goes into the search engine, these like red flashing lights are appearing on my computer. No way. And it's like, danger, alert, dangerous person has possible bankruptcies, owes money on their credit card. I mean, it's like possible, charges. I mean, it's like, oh my God, I'm the sketchy person in the house. For anyone looking us up, I'm the one with you. I'm the sketchy person in the house. And something happened at that moment that just really broke my heart open. I mean, first of all, over this month, I had realized how much we had in common, how many otherizations I had just been making about who they were and how we were different, and how I had made different choices than them, and we were nothing alike. And while we were mourning the death of this rapper, Sketchy, Jesse, the young man who was living in my house, he took out a picture to show me. And he said something. We were standing in my kitchen, and he said, in case you were wondering, and it was a picture of him and his parents. And that in that picture, I saw these two smiling people who looked like every other parent in my PTSA, kids, my kids' school that I had ever, they were every parent that I had ever sold cupcakes with at a Jazz Band B concert. My kid was in Jazz Band B. And I realized, we were just so much more alike than I had ever considered. And what that meant to me was that all the people that I see on the street had so much more in common than I did. They were, in fact, people that I considered strangers, but they were just really neighbors that I just didn't know yet, I'm happy to say that this program now, this Host Home program, is in, it's in 30 cities across America now. It has really high success rates of helping people to, from falling into chronic homelessness. My house guests are both housed now. Kiana, who you can follow on Instagram at Kiana3, I believe. You can look up Kiana Nicole. She has a record deal. She's putting out music. She's living in a house. We get together. She and her new boyfriend were just over. We were doing a yoga class together and having dinner a couple weeks ago. Wow. And, I'm just part of the social network now that she's made in this town. And, I'm so appreciative that she still wants to know me, because I turned out to be the sketchy person in the house.
That's such a good story. Oh my gosh, I love this story so much. How long did they stay with you?
Well, you know, in this host home program, many people host young people, and I just want to say, you know, all kinds of people participate in it. And wherever you're listening, there might be a program near you, because one of the goals now is that one of the reasons why people do come to the cities when they have issues like they've aged out of the foster care system, or there's no employment in their small town, or there isn't a wide safety net where they're living. It's because there are these systems more in place in urban cities. But now these programs are being launched in smaller towns so that people can stay in an area where they have ties. And so if you're listening to this program, you know, maybe there's a host home program near you. You can host people sometimes for like just like a weekend even, but between a month and maybe 6 months, depending upon what you're able to do as a host.
Yeah. Did you really put a hatchet under your bed?
Yes, I did.
Why do you have a hatchet?
Well, it came with the house. This is a thing when this was one of the artifacts that just adds to my artifacts in my garage. It was something I found in the house. And I'm like, I'll never use that. And then I was like, this is the tool that will save my life. The night they moved in, and actually the entire first week, I did not sleep. I kept the windows open thinking if I needed to jump out and make a quick exit onto the roof of my house. Meanwhile, of course, they tell me later, many months later, I find out that they were also thought I was potentially going to murder them. And when you think about it, it's really understandable, because I really was not thinking about how they were so vulnerable going to a stranger's house. Now, there's a vetting process, but still, you know, they were like, do you think she's a sugar mama? Is she going to drug us and sex traffic us? I mean, this is actually a worry, you know, vulnerable people have. So I wasn't even thinking about how vulnerable they were. I was thinking of myself as the vulnerable person.
And so what's so exciting about this story is that you did get, now because I'm not sure how it works, and I don't know if my audience is going to know this either. You got optioned at HBO to write a script about this, or how does that work? What does it mean that you have a story they want?
Well, the way that it works is that I thought this would be a good story, a good setup for a TV series, because it's, you know, it's basically a roommate story of, you know, two families combining a household.
It's like The Odd Couple in a way.
It's like The Odd Couple. Exactly. It's like Friends, but they're not friends. We were matched together. You know, I mean, how do you get to know people and the kinds of relationships you carve and life moments, passages you go through with basically strangers. I thought it'd be a good series, and I was lucky enough to get HBO to sign on. And when you read the story in the book, I hope, you know, you can see the potential in the storytelling. So I'm writing a pilot script now, and then, you know, I'll be sacrificing my firstborn. No, I will not
now,
do
listen,
that.
Now, would you call it a one-hour dramedy, or is it a half-hour? What is it?
It's a half-hour show. You know, I'm a big fan. There's so much interesting TV right now, but I'm a really big fan of the show Dead to Me. I really love that show.
Me too.
And I hope that this show will have certain things in common with that, which is that it starts with, you know, real human and drama of, you know, people who are in really tough moments in their lives, but who come together. And there's also a hilarity. And I love the tone that Dead to Me takes with
murder.
One minute they're crying, and the next one they're laughing. And they're just really the range of really the way life is. It's funny and terrible all at
the same
time.
Pilot would be something like, you know, you just got divorced, Your child just went off to college. You're by yourself in a big house. You've got some space. So that's basically the pilot, really, what you just said.
The pilot is how they come together, like, which is, you know, it's a premise that how people find each other is the premise of a lot of pilots, like the show I loved, Catastrophe. Mm-hmm. That's a great pilot.
I don't see that.
These two people. Oh, it's you can see this all the seasons. It was on HBO, and it's streaming now.
Great.
I think it's on Amazon Prime or something. And you know, it's such a great show because these two very different people. He's kind of a luggish American, and she's British, and they have sex one night, and she gets pregnant, and they decide to make a life together, and it's hilarious. They're so
wow.
different.
Yeah, fun.
And so yeah, so that is the premise of the pilot. And,
well, I hope it goes so much because I totally see it, and I can see show by show how there's these housemates and then these housemates, and maybe one of the housemates becomes successful and then you don't, or you know what I mean, like the homeowner.
Exactly.
All of a sudden, they're competing with
you
know,
who's the sketchy person in the house.
I love it. I love it. Yeah. A wonderful idea, and you are just brilliant. And I'm just so happy with all of your success and how hard you work. You've got such a great work ethic.
Oh my God, Christine, I have no work ethic these days. It's so hard. I have to bribe myself to work. I mean, COVID is sort of, you know, it's been so hard. So for instance, I mean, and I'm just saying this because yes, I write for different newspapers, magazines, I'm writing for HBO, I write books, but I want you to keep, if you're listening, to keep this picture in your mind. You know, there's an underbelly to everyone's life of how they get things done. Yesterday, in order to sit down and write, I ate a loaf of bread. I just feel it's important to acknowledge that it's a tough time and I needed a reward. And I was like, I went out and I bought this baguette and I was like, you know what it's going to take to get me to my office today and to sit and write? A baguette, an entire baguette. It's just really important to acknowledge, I believe, how fucking hard the toll it is. I mean, there's you. I mean, when the schools were shut down, I just thought, how is Christine doing it?
I know.
And I think we've all gone through, everyone has gone through just such a crazy time. We're still going through a crazy time. And I think we have to all be really kind to ourselves.
Yeah. And listen to the Tiny Victories podcast, because that's a nice little bright spot in the day, for sure.
And stories. I mean, that's what I love about Storyworthy, because I think stories help keep us going and just also give us a moment to get lost
in somebody else's story and life.
Yes.
And like what I like about my show is I just try to have a nice, clean, mature, honest conversation with somebody.
Clean, mature, honest? Is that what we're doing? I hope not.
What the fuck?
Christine? No. No, we have to. No, what we're doing here, I love your show because it's stories you won't hear anywhere else.
That's
with
right.
The level of honesty.
Yeah, and we're pushing the envelope, darn it. That's right.
Yes.
We're pushing. Yeah, yeah, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, I love you to death. You guys, head over to AnnabelleGurwitch.com to find out more about Annabelle Gurwitch and buy all of her books. I love your books so much.
I think I just meowed. I meant to say like, but this is what's happened to me. I've been home so much in the last year and a half. I got kittens. And so instead of saying, I went, meow. Christine, I meowed
how
on your
are,
show.
How are your kittens? What? How are the kittens?
Okay, first of all, this is another thing my kid has to correct me with. He's like, Mom, they're not kittens. They have to correct. I said the he, but I misgendered them. Oh my God. Wait, you have to fix that for me. They are like, Mom, they're not kittens anymore because they're a year old. I'm like, they're going to be kittens to me forever, kid. I'm not going to feed them so they stay small. No, I'm not doing that.
I'm sure.
But they're very, because of COVID and I've been home so much, they do sort of follow me around like, you know, we're very attached and I just meowed. So I'm mortified.
I love cats. Aw, I think it's adorable.
Meow.
All right, you guys. One more time on behalf of the very talented Annabelle Gurwitch. Thank you so much, friend. I really appreciate it.
Oh, friend, I adore you, and I just can't believe it's been so long since I've gotten to sit down.
This is nice. Thank you. All right, you guys, my name is Christine Blackburn, saying make it a story-worthy week.
Thanks for joining us on the Storyworthy Podcast. We'll be back next week with all new stories. Subscribe to Storyworthy on iTunes and visit the Storyworthy website at storyworthypodcast.com.